Folks, welcome back to the iHealth Channel, iHealth Radio, the NBC Network, The Works with your host, Hurricane H. New day, new show. Awesome topic, the topic of mental health and relationships and all of the above. Human resilience. I mean, we're going to touch on quite a bit with a special guest. And again, all my guests are special, but you know, we will go extra special today because we're going to talk about psychotherapy and human system optimization. So we're going to talk about a lot of things with our guest today. And our guest is none other than Michael, Dr. Michael Osterlink. Dr. Osterlink, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here. And just for clarity's sake, I'm not a doctor. I have a master's. Okay. Yeah, I just want to clarify. I'm a psychotherapist by license and training. I'm not a psychologist. So I just make those distinctions. That way there's no confusion amongst your listening audience.
No, well, thank you for that. I mean, again, when I see psychotherapist, to me, you know, I mean, it's all semantics. I'm sorry, but
it's mean, all good, man. It's all
I
good.
Get it. I get it. But you know, people get tight about that. So I appreciate the clarification. Yeah. So I'm going to call you Michael.
Michael is perfect.
Michael. Yes, all right. All right. Well, so Michael, you know, it's what you do is an excellent type of work, and you work with people, and the human race is difficult, to say the least, right? We're the humankind, I would say. You know, we're a very complicated species, right? And we tend to have a lot of problems amongst each other. You know, we have feelings, and sometimes we have those things out of control. You and I, we just talked about time, and you know, people live in the past and all this stuff. You know, it's an amazing, you know, creature that we are. But here's the thing. You work with them, you help them get better, be better, and do better. And you're a coach, so you guide people through these sessions and the work that you do. So we're going to talk all about that. But what got you into it in the first place?
Yeah, so you probably go back to 1979 when I was 9 years old. And the story I like to tell is that I had some health and education issues. And my mom took me to see a psychiatrist. And I did the whole hour-long session with a psychiatrist. And keep in mind that I was 9 years old. And at the end of the session, I turned to my mom and I said, "He's fat. He smokes. He can't help himself. He can't help me." And I literally walked out of the room. Now, I was really fortunate, as obnoxious as that was, that my mom actually agreed with me and found me a therapist, not a psychiatrist. And the benefit to me was in 1979, and even today, most psychiatrists would medicate you. Like, you have symptoms and they give you medication. Fortunately, that didn't happen. And I had a therapist, Mrs. Pat Lawson, and she taught me biofeedback, guided imagery, meditation. She got me into the martial arts. So she kind of opened my eyes to what I would retrospectively refer as like self-mastery, management of the nervous system, human optimization, those kind of things. I didn't have that language, you know, in 1979, but I learned how to do those things thanks to her. And that's kind of opened up my eyes to like, what's possible for us as human beings, and then ultimately wanting to do that with other people to help them thrive in their lives.
Ooh, well, again, you know, there's always an important piece about someone who starts their life, you know, as themselves being in the world of need for these the work and the help, because you have a different appreciation, I would say, for it, and a lot of people, and I'm impressed that always that there's quite a. I've had few experiences with people who have had problems or different things when they were younger, and they took upon themselves to choose a path to help others, but doing the same work that they needed at the time when they needed the help. So it's a pretty, you know, cool thing to hear that you needed the work, got the help, and you saw the value, and you took it upon yourself to make it your, I guess, career path.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So it's, by the way, you know, we talked about this, but you know, I just love the setup that you have there. It's a natural setup. You know, for those people that are only listening audio, you know, so you know, Michael is chilling right now. Literally, you know, so hey, but so thank you for that. Now, you mentioned something about imagery and martial arts, so I can relate to the martial arts because and by the way, I started at 79, literally in martial arts, so we have some mark, you know, points on
what you study, what are your some of the arts that you study?
Originally I started do Shotokan karate,
okay,
so that was in 79, and then sometimes in 93 I started taekwondo, and sometimes in 2000 I started ninjutsu or shinobi ryu. So that was like my progression in the arts, and I love them. They're part of me, and it just gives a different level of personal stuff. It's just it is some intriguing, a mystical stuff to martial arts, and most people who have gone into it will tell you that.
Well, it's really interesting you brought up ninjutsu, because I remember when I was 11 or 12, Stephen K. Hayes, wrote quite a few books. Masaaki Asumi, his teacher in the lineage, right. Read his books. So as a little kid, of course, Bruce Lee and all that stuff like that. But like, I was actually discovered the ninjutsu system. And Stephen K. Hayes was teaching out of Ohio at the time. And I did my best, unconvincingly, to convince my father that he should send me to his camp. And I never made it. But it's so awesome that you actually train in ninjutsu. That's always been in the back of my mind since I was a little kid.
Yeah. So our lineage is through Kogaru. If you know anything about those clans, Iga and Koga. That's kind of like the Japanese roots. But then it's Roland Duncan's system, which is Way of the Winds, mm-hmm. and then it was different. Of his pupils or disciples. We trained under him, and so I'm like, four generation, literally student.
That's so cool. Good on you.
But it's awesome to have had the. I mean, both of my professors are gone. I mean, my direct sensei and Shihan now. Mm. He's great guy. I've trained under him full time. Like, that's my main. But then the other two. I mean, they were like our core mentors, or like the heads of the system, and the. Unbelievable stuff, and their personalities were just awesome too. I mean, that's the thing. Like, they just have a different level of interaction with people, and how they calm about themselves. It just teaches. I mean, we're talking about human nature and humankind stuff. Yeah. They're just, it's a different way of living. Your life in
completely agree.
Very controlled way and disciplined way. So, and so the imagery part.
Yeah, the guided imagery. Yeah, so like, I'm sure you've actually probably done this in your various martial arts training. Like, what I was taught as a kid is like, you can imagine yourself doing something in your mind's eye. You're anchored in the breath, you're anchored in the posture, you're anchored in feelings and energetics of the body. And you can teach yourself how to do something in your mind's eye through practice. Doesn't mean you still don't go in the real world and practice. And the most common well-known story along these lines is like basketball players. They'll, in their mind's eye, they'll practice doing the three point, and they actually increase their effectiveness and efficiency to doing so. Now, you still have to practice and really shoot, but that's the kind of things that, as a kid, she taught me how to do, is like to practice in my mind's eye various things that I want to do to increase my confidence. But also, like I said, while also doing the real thing in real life, you can't just do it in your mind's eye. And then a second piece of that for me too is like managing internal states. Like if for instance, I found myself unconfident in something, and I could see myself doing it confidently and breathing fully and relaxing, but I can also see myself, independent of whatever the action is, just as a calm, cool individual. And I can see myself relax, I can see myself breathing fully, and I can see my shoulders relax and down. And so, like, just in the mind's eye, I can change my internal state with that practice. So you can use it for sports, you can use it for public speaking, use it for tons of different things. But you can also just use it to change your state, to get yourself calm, cool, and collected. So she taught me how to do it in both situations.
Well, it kind of sounds like, I mean, first of all, I mean, I love that concept, because, I mean, even today, you hear this in success, trainings and seminars about, like, imagine yourself, and affirm things and start like seeing yourself in their success path and all this stuff. So that works. Yeah. Your mind, works, in reckless ways, right? So the more you think about it, the more you see yourself in a position, the more it manifests, if you want to call it that, right? And it's real. But you started this like when you didn't know anything about this, and it worked. Imagine now you do the work and you help people. And you're right. I mean, the more you practice in your mind stuff, I mean, the mind can take it as real,
And by the way, that's a question. Your mind does take it as real. Yeah.
So that's a question. I mean, because you hear that all the time, does the mind really see the difference between imagination and reality when, in a way, from your perspective?
So, from what I understand to be true, and I'm always open to research, just proving what I'm about to say, but your mind doesn't know the difference. I should say your whole human system doesn't know that there's a difference. So if you see it in your mind's eye, your system acts as if it's true, which makes a lot of sense to me. But like I said, if there's some evidence to prove me wrong, I'm open to that as well. But I've always operated on that as an assumption to be true. And it's all, you know, it's the negative side and the positive side. Like I can imagine myself using my mind's eye and, you know, like being successful and being confident and being, you know, in shape or whatever the thing is I want to do. The reverse is true too. Like if I'm imagining myself in a negative headspace or, you know, unconfident and lack of energy and just bored or whatever the negative thing might be, I'm generating that in my system. And it's a self-referential loop. So like, yeah, do I really want that? No, let's replace the negativity with positivity. And I'm not saying deny, like, you know, if something negative happens to you, it's a reality and you need to deal with it. But like, if you keep circling that negative mind state and keep seeing yourself as a loser or whatever language we use to describe ourselves, we're actually locking that in our system and making it a reality for us. The reverse is true. We can undo that as well and replace it with something more positive.
Well, thank you. I mean, thank you so much, because I, you know, you hear this all the time. I just wanted to get it, you know, from you. I mean, this is part of your expertise, but you're right. I mean, think about it. If we start thinking all bad, all you start seeing is bad. If you start seeing positive, you know, thinking positive, everything you see is positive. So again, you know, we refer to maybe the mindset concept and shift it from mindset to, but really the more you say to yourself things, the mind's going to say, I'm a loser. Then the brain's going to say, you're a loser. and you start behaving as such. And again, loser here, I mean, it's a loose word, because what is a loser versus, you know, what is a winner? I mean, we can debate that, you know, in terms of semantics. But the fact is, we kind of know what that is. You know, maybe like you're not getting the outcomes that are like really, you know, good outcomes. You get all the bad outcomes, right?
And the language matters. And it's what we make meaning of, you know, like, I throw out the word loser, like whatever words we use to describe ourselves in a negative sense, it doesn't have to be loser, whatever it is, has a meaning to us. And then locks that way of feeling and being into place in our system. So whatever the word is or words are, you know, I always recommend clients just become aware of, like, what are the language we use in your own mind when you're talking about yourself? And then I work with couples too. So it's like, oh, what's the language you use when you're actually talking to your partner? You know, and it's tone and volume. It's not just the words we use, but the tone and volume matter. And I have people really become aware of that and then shift. Like, are you speaking poorly of yourself? That's going to have an effect. Cool. Let's work on that as one example.
Well, thank you. I love it. Well, first of all, thank you for just highlighting the idea of the word loser versus not. I mean, but you're right. It's any word that we describe ourselves.
Yeah.
And frankly, you know, it is appropriate because many of us can actually start thinking that way, or maybe we can think of someone as such and tell them that, and maybe we can affect them adversely. So at the end of the day, if we're aware, as you mentioned, we will only do better, you know, by controlling some of the words and knowing what we say and when we say it and how we say it, as you said, the tone, it makes a change, you know, in terms of the outcome, right?
Very much so.
that's the work you do. I mean, you know, people come in with all these issues and you kind of analyze the issues and then you discover all these little things or habits that are being in place, and ultimately they're just changes that need to be made, and hopefully things will get better. So now let's talk about that. I mean, we humans, again, difficult species, there is something that we refer to as issues, but there's also human resilience. So let's talk about what that is, you know, as a concept.
So let me refer to you to, there's a men's group that a colleague of mine, J.C. Glick, and I launched a couple months ago. J.C. Glick is a former Army Ranger, and we call it Resilience 2.0. And I think the distinction between 1.0 and 2.0 is useful for this conversation. So we attract a lot of military guys in our program, and we would joke, like, actually J.C. would joke mostly because he's an Army Ranger, and he'd say, like, This is not getting up at 4:30 in the morning like Jocko Willink and taking a picture of your watch and then kicking butt, or doing a 100-mile race before breakfast like David Goggins. And nothing wrong with that. Like, you know, challenging yourself physically is really important and seeing what you're capable of. But for us, resilience is like, that's great. Let's do that. And 2.0 is, are you able to sit in the discomfort of your own experience without looking distracting yourself? A lot of guys go for porn or drugs or alcohol or Netflix, or they work, you know, because they don't like what's happening inside their own system. They don't like the feelings or their thoughts. So they look for the distractions. So are you able to sit in the discomfort of your own experience? Are you able to do that with your partner, like your wife? Like she's, you know, and I've been given permission by female friends of mine to say it's messy. Women are messy. So, you know, your partner is messy. She's going through whatever she's going through. Are you so uncomfortable that you need to fix her because you're uncomfortable that she's having a hard time? Or are you able to sit in that discomfort of her experience without having to fix her and just hold the space for her and find out exactly what she needs? Most men are like, no, I need to, you know, like they don't think about this, but I want to fix her. I don't want her to be uncomfortable because it makes me uncomfortable. Or your children, or we live in a VUCA world, volatile, uncertain, chaotic, and it's getting crazier. And like, are you able as a man to stand up? And it's not just men, women too, but like I work with men in this case. Like, are you able to stand up and sit in the center of the cyclone of what's happening around you and stand out as a leader in your community? It could be at your work. It could be you live in your neighborhood. Like, what does your community need of you to find that space inside of you that where you're centered, you're calm, you're cool, you're operating from your heart, you're operating from the mind, and you're forward thinking. Like, I have like an offensive mindset. I want to take on this challenge. I'm gonna take on this challenge. That's resilience 2.0 for us. And that's what we've been working with our men on, is how to develop the capacities inside of ourselves to be able to do all of those things with ourselves, with our partners, with our community.
Thank you. So I mean, there's the physical resilience, which is basically what your body can do and all the good stuff. You can push it to the extreme. And then you have your mental resilience, which is like, you know, I think what you're referring to, whereby you can be able to control some of that and you know, not deflect or just kind of drown yourself in things, you know, because you just cannot really face the music in a way. Go ahead. No, please.
I was just gonna say, no judgment. Like we all of us, including myself, and I've been doing this forever. Like, you know, we find ourselves on occasion, and many times for many occasions, so uncomfortable with what's going on inside ourselves that we have means of distracting ourselves. And I've named a few: what, porn, or drugs, or alcohol, or work, whatever it is. So it's not judgment. Like we all do that to some degree or another. The trick is, if you want to become really resilient, is like stop doing that. Stop looking for the distraction and learn to sit in your own uncomfortable feelings, or that of your partners, or that of your kids, or your workmates. And part of that is emotional resilience. Part of that's mental toughness. Like, you know, front side focus with the mind. The emotions might be all over the place, but kind of remain calm, cool, and centered. And I'm not denying my emotions. I'm not denying the crazy thoughts that go through my mind. I'm just not being driven by those things. And that's resilience for us.
So you basically, you're in control in degree to your emotions. I mean, you can control how you react. I mean, you're still realistic about what's going on, but you're just not trying to blame the world for things, or just kind of like, you know, put a blind, you know, on your stuff and just try to, the world is peachy and there's nothing. I'm just going to keep going.
You know, a great word to describe what you just said is like sovereignty. I'm a sovereign individual. I'm not at cause. Like nothing else is causing me to feel certain things. Now, you could say, yeah, my wife says this or my kids do this and it triggers and stuff inside of me. All true, but I can choose not to respond. I might have something going on inside of me like, oh, like that makes me feel unhappy or sad or angry or whatever it is. Okay, cool. But I don't have to act on those feelings. And that's where the self-mastery comes in. We're not saying deny how you feel. Feelings are they provide you with all valuable information about yourself and the world around you. What we're saying is like, can you master them towards higher ends? Goes back to the martial arts, man. Like, hey, martial arts are great for fighting sometimes and for physical fitness, but ultimately that's not what it's about. It's character development. How courageous are you? How much integrity do you have? How much care and compassion do you have? It's the same stuff, that just in a different format. It's not on the mat. It's just the bedroom, boardroom, or battlefield, or whatever, you know.
But you're right. And you know, I mean, again, talking about the martial arts, many great folks out there, you know, they take martial arts as a supplement or as a source of energy and discipline and all of the above, because it keeps you, you know, in control. I mean, it keeps you part of a system, keeps you part of a family, but also it gives you that confidence and you can control things different. Like everybody can get mad quickly. I mean, we're all capable of like losing the cool, right? But, you know, if you have a little bit of a level of control, you can do better. You can actually like, okay, this is not going to, there's nothing I need to do here. Plus, especially if you know that, you know, like the other day I was watching a clip from Joe Rogan and he said like, you know, if you're going to train, you know, you need to train to fight someone who knows how to fight, not someone who's not, you know. And so, because technically that's what it is. I mean, because if you get somebody that's trained, it's going to be bad, right? But if you know can do that, then your confidence level is going to be different. You're not going to be in a place where you, you know, you'd be like doubtful and stuff, and you can stand up, you know, to the situation. In this, it's like standing up to your own situation in your environment. But so, wouldn't that take some accountability? Because I think as humans, we have a problem with that. I mean, how many of us, and listen, we're all guilty. I would say, at least I am. It is a difficult, you know, place to always, because we have ego, we have maybe some level of narcissism, I don't know. But we do have a me, myself, and I kind of attitude at all of us, right? I mean, most of us, if not all of us. And, you know, but we don't take the blame. We don't take it like we are also part of the problem. I mean, that, because there's no matter what situation there is, you are part of it. I mean, we are, right? I mean, if there's two people having an argument, you know, it's not, we can't possibly meet one versus the other. Maybe one is the trigger, but we both are part of the problem. so let's talk about that.
So no, I think you nailed it. Like, you know, Jocko Willink has this extreme ownership, like you own everything. And I really like that. And it's not to say you discount other people's, like, their role in things. Because, yeah, if it's two of you, it takes two to tango. They're playing a role in that situation. And hopefully you have two mature people and they both can take responsibility for their part in that. It doesn't always happen. Like, one person might, the other person might blame the other person. You know, the dynamics will change based on the individuals. But when I work with individuals, or in this case, this group, I ask them to be more aware of how they do the lack of sovereignty or how they do the trigger. If I said to you X, Y, and Z, you say, oh, that makes me really mad. I say, okay, cool. Well, I want to pretend like I don't know what you mean by you're mad, I'm angry. Like, how do you know that you're angry? And you might say to me, well, hey, Mike, when I get angry, a little tightness in my jaw, I hold my breath a little bit, my heart rate goes a little bit faster. I'm ready, almost like in a fighting position, ready to take on the world. I said, okay, cool. So you know how you do anger in this case. That's awesome. The more subtly aware of how you do it, like literally how you construct your whole posture and your mindset and the words you use and the breathing pattern and the muscle tension, how you all do that. The more you're aware of that, the more we can use that to intervene, to reprogram you. And that's what I do with clients. Now you know how you do what you do. Let's replace it with something that's more constructive towards the ends that you see. And first, you have to know how you do the old pattern, and then we replace it with a new pattern. And it can take some time because it's a habit you build into your nervous system. It takes time to kind of replace it. And my ultimate goal with clients is to give you choice. So you're not reactive to the situation, you're responsive. And the response could be whatever. Like, I want to be angry, cool. I want to be sad, cool. I mean, whatever you want to do. At least there's a modicum of decision on your side, as opposed to I'm just reactive. And this is what I always do in this situation. I want you to have some freedom to choose how you want to respond. And then I work with clients to be more playful. Like, hey, try something different. Like, what you've been doing ain't working, right? Oh, no. Okay. Well, let's change your nervous system to free it up. So it's less rigid and contracted and be more free. And let's try new things. And the new things are fun, especially in partnerships, because like both of people agree. Like, hey, what we've been doing ain't working. Let's try something different. And they try new things. It's more playful. It's more fun. It's more interesting. It's good for you as an individual, but it's also good for you in a partnership too, to have more of a playful mindset or a growth-oriented mindset, or however you want to articulate it. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Mike. Well, so that leads us to again, the relationship concept. I mean, everybody, when they meet someone, it's peachy. It's beautiful, right? It starts always good. Well, you know, and then things don't work out. What drives that? I mean, you know, I mean, in your expertise, like what you find, what kind of issues or triggers that really get people to go from like, we love each other, we're like so excited about being with each other, to like, we hate each other and let's just having a fight every day, you know?
So and that's a great question. I'll say at least two things. And I always like to say and, because there's always tons of different ways of responding to your question. But so at least two things that I've discovered. One is inauthenticity of either or both people in the beginning of the relationship. They're on their best behavior. They think they know how the other person wants them to show up, and they show up that way as opposed to who they really are. So they get trapped into like this, I wear this mask. And eventually the mask gets old because you're like, ah, that's not me. and eventually your true self starts coming out. And your partner's like, who the fuck are you? Like that's not who I first started dating and seeing, right? So like, you know, the trick is to be as sincere as possible at the very beginning. And then the second piece of that is too, is like red flags. Like, you know, the hormones fly and we're in la la land. And I would guess that if you talk to that person about someone else in that same situation, they would say, oh yeah, there's a red flag, but they're in the situation. They can't see it because they're in love or like, or the hormones, whatever. So it's like, you need to start paying attention through the fantasy of the love and the hormones and see the person as they truly are, and then take better decisions. And part of that is, you know, like I said, like, what are the red flags? Things that don't serve, like, there might be certain behaviors you're like, oh, I'm going to ignore. But, you know, you ignore for a little while, and then, like, they start annoying the shit out of you, and they start bothering you. And it's like, if you would have paid attention at the very beginning, like, and it's not, you need to judge the other person's bad or evil unless they do those bad things. It's just sort of like, they're just different. They have different values than you. They have different ways of operating the world. They have different perspectives, which is completely fine. But you want to meet them where they're at, see who they really are, and then take better decisions. So it's like sincerity of authenticity, and then seeing them as they really are, and for them to see you as you really are, and then take better decisions early on, before it's too late.
Well, thank you. Well, so that opens up a whole different discussion. One is, you know, about, again, as you said, people coming with a facade and an actual a persona that is not themselves. Yeah. Because there's an expectation. Is that something that is being created by a society and social, you know, aspects of things? Because I think we all want to live to a certain expectation of what a date should look like, what, you know, how you're supposed to behave. I mean, I'm going to be as blunt as this. I mean, when you get married, I mean, you know, people fart, people do all kind of crazy stuff that they were not doing when they first dated, right? You know, and so you know, people are almost behaving, you know, as like, you know, they're this perfect being, but we're not perfect beings. And so, you know, they show up in the wrong aspect of things, or at least they try to portray, like, you know, a different personality. And then, like, you know, as you said, what the hell is this character? This is not the person I'm the first day. You know, so right. is that triggered or being driven by the way we are being taught how to behave when we meet somebody?
Well, I would say it even goes further back. It probably goes to family of origin, because a little child, and they don't have the cognitive capacity as an adult, and they do the best they can do to adapt to the situations they find themselves in. But, you know, they create defense mechanisms or ways of engaging the world to protect themselves against real perceived threats. And a lot of that could be, I'm going to deny certain feelings. Like in my household, anger is not allowed, so I better repress my anger. Or there's nothing to be happy about. So you have this, oh shit, I better not be happy about anything. So, you know, like, you create these masks we wear so we can survive in our family of origin. And then we also see, like, how our parents, if you have a two-family household, like how they engage with one another. And that teaches you, oh, this is what a wife does, this is what a husband does, what a father does, what a mother does, or whatever the combination might be. And you learn that way. And a lot of that is just, and I don't mean this in a pejorative way, because, you know, everyone does their best. But it's all based on masks and personas that we've created going all the way back. Your parents did it to survive with their parents did it to survive with their parents, you know. And the only thing we have now going for us differently is that we have the ability, through knowledge and wisdom, therapy, coaching, books, you know, that are so widely available, that we start asking questions like, do I really need to show up this way? Do I really need to behave this way? Is this defense mechanism that I've created to protect myself, does it really serve me presently? It might have when I was 5 or 7 or 10, but I'm a 40-year-old man. Does it really help me now, or a 35-year-old woman? No. Let's replace it with something that's more constructive to the ends that you seek, as one example.
Well, thank you. So do you find in the work you do that, for example, generations have different ways of dealing with things? I mean, because if you look at a couple that's been married or together for 50 years plus, they have a different formula of how they behaved and how they work together to make it. I mean, you know, it's not easy to make it 50 years or plus, right?
Yeah.
And that's one question. The other one is, do you think, for example, in today's age where people match online, for example, and in apps and stuff, you know, is there a correlation to these problems that is stemmed from the type of connection that we have, or the type of meeting that we have, structure, as opposed to, like, because back in the days, I mean, people college sweethearts. They met, you know, when they were kids, they stayed together and they died together.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's like you spend the whole life with that same person. Here, it's like, I got to do some trial phases here. You know, we're going to test different apps and so on and so forth. So is there in your work, you know, do you see a distinct, you know, difference between the behavior of certain generations, pre-tech and post-tech?
It's a great question. And I'll give you my father as an example. So I have a podcast like you, and I've been podcasting since 2008. And so my father is like my number one fan. So he listens to my interviews, and he and I have a conversation about it. And I love it. I mean, just because I love my father, and it's cool that he listens to it. But my takeaway from listening to him talk about my podcast, because he'll say something like, when I was that age and I was raising you as your father, and I was raising you and your little kid, our generation, we did things differently. The husband didn't take care of the kids. He went to work. He came home. We had dinner and he watched TV and went to bed. Like, and maybe even threw the football. Like, but there's no like, you know, like what parents can now do, like husbands can now, or fathers can now do, like changing the diapers. Like my father never did that. Like that just wasn't part of the generation. And he'll say, man, I wish I would have known then what I know now from listening to what you talk about when I interview experts in family systems or parenting, whatever. And I really appreciate that, because he's acknowledging like the way they did it back then is different than the way they do it now. And he thinks the way we do it today is a little bit better than back then, but it wouldn't change. Like, even if he knew back then what he knows now, the social pressures are men do this and women do this. And, you know, most, they're not going to cross. But today you have a little more flexibility, so women can try things that men did, and men can do things that women could, you know, do back and forth. And I think that's where you'll find some of the opportunities for trying new things in the parenting space, as one example. And that's generationally different. Yeah, for sure.
So there is a positive there. Yeah. It sounds like we've evolved a little bit, and you know, and I think, by the way, I personally think it's okay. I mean, I have kids, I do chores, I do all the stuff, and yeah. You know, my parents were just about that. They did both things. I mean, so although my father did, you know, he was working, my mom wasn't, but he was also participating and stuff. So it was a little different, but I see, okay. You know, as a fair thing, you know, it's only fair to share things, right. And duties and to help each other. But again, it takes, again, two out of tango, as you said, you know, you gotta
right.
know your, it's like a yin yang, you gotta work together. You can't all press one way or the other. Otherwise, that's, I think, where everything bursts, right? You gotta have a good balance. Like everything in a good harmony balance works better in this world.
Yeah, completely agree. And when I work with couples, one of the things I highlight is agreements. Because a lot of people come into relationships and they believe in mind reading. Oh, he should know what I'm thinking. She should know what I'm thinking. They don't, because they don't read minds, and there's a lot of miscommunication, a lot of anger, a lot of resentment builds up over time. I'm like, oh, let's have some agreements on how we actually deal with problems. This is how we discuss them. Like, and maybe one of the agreements is like no ruminations. Like if you're starting to think about something and wondering what the other person meant, ask the other person. Like that's just an agreement. Because what I found is like, if you don't ask the other person, you just start ruminating. You're making shit up in your own head. This is what they meant. This is what they 90% of the time you ask, you finally ask them after weeks of going crazy inside your own head, or hours or days, you're like, holy moly, like I was thinking this and you're actually thinking something completely different, and it could reduce my suffering if I had just asked you. So like agreements, like how do you actually communicate? Well, one thing is don't read minds, because in most cases you can't just openly share what's going on inside your human system.
Well, you're right. I mean, no, we don't read minds, and that's a fact. But I can tell you, I mean, the more you're closer to a person, the more you kind of by signal, you know more or less what they're going to think or what they're going to talk about. But that takes a lot of work together. And as you said, initial communication to understand each one. But of course, it's not a 100% bulletproof. It's a degree, you know, there is a percentage where that works and sometimes it doesn't. But you got to ask. You know, it's not difficult, but we all have that difficulty, right?
And I love the idea, like you spend enough time with someone, you kind of get to know them, and you can almost mind read to a certain extent. But and that's all true. Like you pick up body language, you can see their facial expression, their eyes, or like you know, whatever it is. You're like, oh, I know what's going on. And maybe you're correct. But what I found in many situations is we turn our partner into a rock. Oh, I know exactly what they're going to think and feel and do, based on my experiences with him for the last 5, 10, 15, 20, how many years it is. And we don't give them the space to be creative, playful, and try something new. We assume they're going to do X, Y, and Z. They've always done X, Y, and Z. And my suggestion is like, yeah, maybe you are a mind reader and you know your partner really well and you kind of predict what they're going through. And there might be moments where that might not be the best strategy. Be curious. Ask them questions. Give them the opportunity to be playful and try something new and kind of shock and surprise you.
But it's amazing, right? Because, you know, I think one of the things that can make relationship work longer is that you always want to discover new things about your partner, right?
Yeah.
And I think we all are capable of new things at all times, because as we age, as we mature, we change, and it's adaptability. You got to keep changing along. You know, sometimes if one wants one way or the other, then that doesn't work. I mean, there's a point where you're not going to have the same likes and the same things and the same trends and the same, like, I want to travel. You don't want to travel. I want to eat, you know, this. You don't want to eat. I want to watch this kind of movie. You want to watch this kind of movie. And then it becomes complete opposites. And now it's not a cool thing. And I think that goes to that item that you talked about, the roots of the origin, the family. Yeah. Remember, you know, if we took it from our parents, then we will also dish it out to our next generation. So if we're not smart about it, we're going to, you know, teach that behavior to the next generation, which probably, and we see that. I mean, I've seen that happen where kids who have, observed or experienced hardship between the parents, they tend not to want to get married or be in relationships, So what is that construct?
Yeah, so it's really interesting because I was just interviewed today on the discussion around this, and it was about, it's with a colleague of mine, and we're talking about intergenerational transmission of trauma as one example. Hmm. So, like, you know, if the mother, she's pregnant, she has the baby inside of herself, and maybe she's physically abused or sexually abused or mentally abused or whatever it is, it will have an effect on the baby. You know, and the baby will grow up seeing the mother treated a certain way, and then the daughter or the son will have expectations of how another human being treats, in this case, the mother or a mother in this case. And it's transmitted. Now, not everyone follows that path. Like, you can have someone who, like, was completely abused as a child, and they're the nicest person in the world. They're not going to continue the abuse. So it's always possible to break out of these cycles. But it's important to recognize these cycles, these things that are transmitted down the family line. And then take decisions like, maybe I don't want that behavior to continue on into my kids or my kids' kids. So I need to stop with me. Cool. Then you need to do the work to make sure you stop it with you. So you're not transmitting it to your kids and then to their kids and to their kids. Yeah. So it's an awareness exercise and a lot of work too.
Well, thank you. So in your work, do you see that there is a difference between how a male behavior is and a female behavior is? I mean, does that even factor in terms of how they deal with the situation? I mean, is it just really the gender? Is it the actual hormones? Is it just, like, you know, the behavior? How does that work, at least in the experience and the cases that you've dealt with?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'd say there are some differences and yet a lot of similarities. And the way I might articulate it is like masculine and feminine. Mm-hmm. Because a man can be feminine, can be masculine, a woman can be feminine and masculine. You know, so they both have the potential growth characteristics. So you might want to be able to say, like, someone who's more masculine oriented is very front side focused, they're charging towards whatever the challenge might be, you know, that kind of mental approach. And you find, like, in the business space, a lot of people in the business space, men or women will have that approach. You know, success, strive, drive, I got to work really hard. Cool. And you can have someone who has a more a feminine approach, more open, more receptive, more playful. You know, the energies kind of float through the system as opposed to being so front-side focused and charging towards whatever the thing is. So both men and women can have either one of those kind of characteristics or those approaches to life. Men tend to have more of the masculine, not all men. Women tend to have more of the feminine, but not all women. So, you know, there's a mixture. And our culture has an effect on that too. Like, you know, as more women enter the workspace over the last 30 years, there's a requirement for more of them to be more masculine oriented, meaning the hard drivers, success oriented, right? Okay. So there's a way that the culture also drives those ways of being in the world too.
All right. Well, so a couple of things that we all kind of have in life. One is some sort of a fate or not, and or finances. These are big, I guess, factors in life. Do you see that these have any type of impact on relationships and connections?
You said faith and finances? Just want to make sure.
Yeah. Faith or religion, you know.
Faith.
Yeah.
Okay, faith.
Faith and religion and or, sorry, you know, finances. I mean, both of them are big. I mean, let's face it, maybe at a point in life, you know, people did not intermix in religion stuff. Now we have that. You know, cultures, right? So you have that part. And then you have the other part, which is the finances. You know, someone can be, you know, from maybe a rich family and someone from not as much. And so now they connected, but now would that be a challenge for them? Because, you know, we say love, you know, beat all that, but is that really true? So is there such a thing? Is there reality to this fact? And, you know, what can we tell people about that?
I think those are two great things to explore. So faith, from my understanding of the research, couples that have similar faiths and actually are practicing whatever religious system they are operating in, seemingly have better mental outcomes. Okay. Doesn't mean that an atheist or an agnostic person can't be happy and fruitful and successful in their lives. But from what I understand, the research, being faith oriented, whatever the faith is a positive social driver, you know, a pro-social driver. And I could imagine, depending family of origin, like if two people come from completely different faiths and they seem to be competing faiths, like in the world stage, they don't do well with each other. I can see that as a problem, depending on the familial drivers. Like if it's really important for the mom and dad, for their kid to be married into their religious system, and the kid chooses someone else that's not part of that, are they going to be excommunicated? Are they going to be thrown out of the family? You know, all those are important questions. Like here in the States, less so. Like I think we have such a mixture of people that most times, unless you're like first or second generation from another country, it's less of a problem. Not that it's not a problem. And also it depends on where. Like I have to imagine like Jersey, New York, San Francisco, you know, California, some of the more city-oriented places, the big cities, it's probably easier to cross mix faiths and such, unless you're from an ethnic group that's really hardcore and you're first generation, that could be a problem. And the financing thing, you know, let me see if you have a question on that, from my understanding of how that lands for you.
Oh, that's perfect. And okay. Again, I mean, you're right. I mean, sometimes it works for people. And, you know, I think when you love someone, when you connect with someone, it doesn't matter, right? I mean, you make the sacrifice, and we know that. But they can also be problems, because not so much because of the couple, because maybe the influences from the parties, as you said. The family can be putting too much pressure now, you know, or they're not going to see the kids, or I'm going to go do Christmas here, I'm going to do this party, you know, this holiday here. Now you're separating. But if you had it all in one, you know, the same concept, it would be a lot easier, right? It would be a lot simpler. But you're right. We have a lot more of that today than, I mean, I think 50 years ago was much different than it is today.
Oh, yeah.
We have a lot more, I guess, acceptance of the other in terms of cultures and religion and stuff. And so there's a more of a mix in. And the other one is the finances, because that's a big one. You know, sometimes people are being frowned upon because of their background, or, you know, old money versus new money, or no money.
Or no money, yeah. You know, it's interesting on the money thing. And all these things, in my opinion, offer an opportunity for the couple to be more conscious of how they interact with one another and themselves, and the programs they bring into the relationship. You know, because, if for instance, one person came from a poor family background, and they don't know how to handle large amounts of money, like they're very conservative, like I don't spend money because you never know if you're not going to have it. And the other person's like, I come from a wealthy family, we just spend money, whatever, like who cares? Like, there's never been a problem. So those are two different mindsets, and those two mindsets can be problematic. So you have one person saying, don't spend a dime, and understandably so from their history and background, and the other person saying, let's spend every dime we have. Like, that's a conversation that needs to take place, especially even before you get married and start having kids and trying to figure all that out. Yeah.
Well, but these are all things that you handle, I mean, on a regular basis in your coaching system. So now you are a conscious relationship coach, right? That's what.
Yes.
So what does that entail?
Three different areas. So I work with individuals, and I have a very particular program that I've created for individuals that we dial in the physiology, their psychology, their social systems, their environment for maximizing the growth and human development. I work with couples, which you just acknowledged, and I also run groups too. And I talked about the group with JC Glick and the men's group on resilience 2.0. Conscious coupling is like, I want people to come in and recognizing that when they come together, they're bringing in their family of origin, their ethnicity, their nationality, their religion. There's a lot of streams that come in kind of the background of who they are, which drives their behaviors, their worldviews, their perspectives, how they show up in the world. And if they're not really conscious of it, it can cause a lot of conflict with the other person. And if they are conscious about it, like, I'm aware of like why I do what I do, and maybe I don't want to do what I do, but I learned how to do that from my family of origin. Okay, cool. Let's be aware of that, and let's change your behavior over time. Change your approach, change your perspective. But if I'm unconscious and my unconscious stuff, like from family of origin or nationality or religion, is driving my behaviors, I'm like a robot. I'm just being programmed and operating the world. And that's not, you know, my preference is for human beings to be a choice, to operate from a loving, caring place, not from a rigid, you know, like a programmed place from their childhood. Recognize that, but like create some freedom, be playful, be loving, be caring, you know, less rigid. Being conscious or aware is the first step of that. Like I need to be aware of how I am rigid, how I am contracted, how I'm afraid, how I am insecure. So I can work through those kind of things and show up differently in my relationship with my partner. That's where the consciousness kind of comes in through. Yeah.
That's quite a bit of work.
Yeah.
Now, for someone, I mean, people can join the program and, you know, whichever program they need in this particular case, whether they're a couple or a group. Now, when you refer to group, it can, like, I can particularly come into a group concept or do I have to have a group ready to come in? I mean, how does that work?
Great question. So I run groups or I co-lead groups. So it's like, for instance, the men's group that JC and I are running, I think October comes to an end and we'll have a new cohort come in. So anyone that might be interested in our men's group, they can join us like in October, somewhere early October, middle of October. I will also, and I have done this over the years, like if you have a group of people that you want to work through some stuff together and do some team building, I can come in and do that. I can come in there for like a week, or I can come in there for 48 hours, fly in, do some really intense cool stuff, and then leave. You know, so that's different than me running a group for 6 months. This is more like a group that pre-exists that I come in and then help grow and evolve and adapt and learn. That's a distinction I'd make on the group side of things.
So yeah. Thank you. Now there is the concept of relationship and all this stuff, but what about in the business world, in the corporate world? I mean, training, you know, for leaders maybe or team concept. Do you do any of that, you know, to coach them?
Yeah.
To
Yeah. So the way I look at it is I would not consider myself a business coach. Like I don't help you build your business. But I can speak to a particular client I have who runs a multi-million-dollar business. I don't help him build a better business. That's not my skill set. I help him build a better person. So he's a better leader. He's a better manager. So his business improves, but I don't work directly with him to improve his business. I work directly with him to improve himself. So he's a better human, better man, better owner, better, you know, leader, better CEO, that kind of stuff, if that makes sense.
That's exactly what I was asking. It's just that it's more about the people skills and the personality, the character, as opposed to, if you're good, because a lot of people can run good business, but they can really run staff bad, or they don't have a good relationship with anybody that works with them or for them. That can be, you know, brutal. So that's why I was asking, like, because I mean, it sounds like you could do great work also in the corporate space in training, you know, conflict of interest and, you know, behavioral stuff and, you know, getting people more to get together as a team and be a unit, as opposed to being, I mean, you're talking about your partner being in the army. That's a huge team, you know, and you got to work as one element, right? So, and that's what it takes in the corporate world as well. So I was just, you know, curious as to whether you do any of that. Now you have, so there's three programs basically you're running right now.
Yeah. Yeah, if you don't mind, I'll speak to the individual one that I run, if that's cool.
Please. Yeah, yeah.
So there's four pillars that I found really of importance to me when I work with a client. One is physiological. How's your diet and nutrition? How's your movement? How's your fitness? How's your stress management? Are you living within the 24-hour circadian biological system, the night-day cycle? What's your relationship to nature? You know, those kind of things. Because I find if you're not eating well, you're not sleeping, you're not moving, you're not dealing with your stress well, and your whole system's dysregulated, it's going to be hard to make positive changes. But if you dial those things in, and I work with clients to do stuff, they feel better, they have more energy, they have more clarity, and then they can start making the psychological changes. And for me, psychologically is cognitive, like how they think. Like we talked about earlier, what's the scripts going inside their head? Are they positive or are they negative? You know, are they driving them towards positive behaviors or are they keeping them like small and contracted? Emotions, like how do you handle your emotions? We talked about that earlier. Are you able to manage them well? Not deny them, not repress them, but manage them. Your energetics of the body, like how do you deal with the energy of your physical body? Like do you find yourself crashing in the middle of the day? Or like wide awake in the middle of the night, like 3 o'clock in the morning, like, oh my God, what's going on? You know, so like I have people become much more aware of other energetic systems and how to manage them towards the ends that they seek. Somatically, like how's your breath? Like I spend a lot of time with people on their posture, the muscle tone, the breathing patterns. Because what I find is like, you know, as one example, if you're stressed, most likely you'll make poor decisions if you're not breathing well. But if I can teach you how to just do a easy breathing pattern, calm your whole system down, you have more access to the prefrontal cortex, which is the thinking part of your mind or your brain, you'll make better decisions. So even that is one example, like working somatically with someone can be really helpful. And then spiritually too. And for me, that has a couple of different meanings. One is like, what is your spiritual path? How can I support you on that? Whatever that is for you. You know, maybe you're a Christian Catholic or you're Jewish or you're a Muslim or you're Buddhist, whatever the thing is that you follow. You know, how can I support you on that path if it's meaningful for you? Cool. Awesome. And then also values. And this is really an important part of my program. What are your values and do you embody them? So if you said to me, hey, Mike, you know, integrity is really important. And then I talk to you, you know, like the next half an hour, I'm like, well, you claim it's important. And I see how you're living your life and there's a mixed match. Holy shit, dude. Like, you know. Or you might say, you know, love is really important. I'm a loving husband or a loving father. And then I find out how you actually are. I'm like, wow, you know, you claim your value, but you're not living your value. Let's have that conversation. Maybe you need to rethink your values or you need to learn how to live your values. So that's for me, spirituality, an important part of the program. So that's the physiological and the psychological. The social is how are your relationships, like with your spouse, your workmates, your family, your community. Are those relationships supportive of your growth and development or contract against your growth and development? So like if you said to me, I want to grow. And I found out from you that your wife is like, I don't want him to grow. She won't say that directly, but she like watches any efforts you might put into growing. Because she's afraid. She's afraid like she'll lose you if you grow too much. You know, I understand that dynamic. So like, oh, I might have a conversation with your spouse to get her to understand that you're not growing to leave her, you're growing because you're growing as a human being. She grows as a human being and could benefit both of you as a couple. You know, so like how are the social dynamics and how can I support growth in the social dynamics? And then environmental design is the last piece of it. It's like, is your home, transportation, and office supportive of these new behaviors, these new ways of being? Or are they just distracting you from these new ways of being? And that literally, what's in your pantry? What's in your closet? Like, how do you organize your home? What's your cyberspace look like? You know, just tons of questions on how you actually live your life and is conducive to the kind of life you want to lead. And I'll give you two examples. I call it via negativa and via positiva. So via negativa is like, what do I need to remove from my environment to support new behaviors? And like, if you said to me, hey, Michael, you know, I'm trying not to eat sugary snacks. I'm like, okay, you invite me over to your home and I'm in your office and literally on your desk is a bowl of M&Ms. I'm like, okay, let's have that conversation. Like, you know, you don't want to be eating sugar. You're spending all your time looking at it, not eating it, but you're probably already eating it. Via negativity, like, let's remove that from your desk. Like, that's just a silly thing to have in front of you that's going to distract you and possibly cause you to eat poorly. So what do we need to remove that is not healthy for you? And via positiva is like, what do we need to add? And this is my favorite example. So I will train people up for kind of intense physical activities or events. And I had one client who's training up for Cockerel Camp. I work for one of the hats I work for SailFit. I work for Commander Mark Devine at SailFit. Cockerel Camp is modeled after Hell Week. It's 2 days of intense physical training, multiple different environments, multiple different evolutions. And I had a client training for that. And the requirement is like, I think it's like 18 pull-ups. I can't remember exact requirements from PST. And I'm like, oh, I said, so I talked to this client. I'm like, when are you doing your pull-ups? He goes, well, when I go to the gym. I said, no. Get a pull-up bar and put it at the doorway of your office, your home office. Every time you leave your office, you go to the bathroom, get coffee, go pee, whatever you're doing, you got to do knock out a couple pull-ups. So literally, anytime you walk underneath it, you have to do a couple pull-ups. Anytime you walk back through, you have to do a couple pull-ups. But at the end of the day, it's only like 20 extra pull-ups every day, just by walking underneath. So that's the via positiva. What can we add to your environment to support these new behaviors? And that's just one fun example of like, oh, pull-up bar sounds cool.
Yeah. I like, it's hard, but I like it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
The program. Yeah.
So how long does the program take for someone that's interested in joining the program?
6 months. And it's the funniest thing. I actually try to convince people not to do the program. You're going to be like, that's kind of crazy. It's work intensive, like spot drills, crucibles, homework. Like it's a whole person, whole system, deep dive, almost like a PhD program. For 6 months. So you need to come in to work with me, willing to do work. It's not, you don't talk to me every other week. You just talk about stuff. No, you actually have to do a lot of work. So like only if you're willing to do the work, should you do the program. I don't want to waste my time or your time. Yeah.
You find any particular group of people or type of specific people that actually are inclined to join the program or?
Yeah, it's usually, people on the looking for their next edge for their life. Like they're successful, but they know that something else is available to them. And they might be successful in the workplace or maybe even successfully married. They might have a nice family, but they know it's like something else is missing. And they're like, what might that be? And I want to really take my life to the next level. And so like those are the kind of people who come to me. So they're already hard chargers. They're already willing to do the work. They've done hard work to get to wherever they're at. They're like, there's something else. I'm ready for the next level of my function. Cool. So like, it's less likely the guy just literally fell off the couch. It's more like he's been off the couch for a long time doing whatever he does, and he wants to take his life to the next level. Yeah.
So midlife crisis works?
which is great because it's really funny you say it, put it that way. I have probably about half my clients in their 50s. Late 40s, early 50s, sometimes early 60s, who are very much like that. Like, yeah, midlife crisis, but I don't want to go buy a fast car and do stupid shit. Like, I really want to improve my life. Cool. We can do that. Yeah.
Well, listen, I mean, one of the things that we all ought to be doing, you know, and you know, we should, and we all need to strive for is that to improve ourselves, right? And personal development is great. This is a very good way to do that and to just go to the next level, whatever that next level is. But yeah. You're right. I mean, it does take commitment. It does take, you know, that this is going to be, your resilience is going to be in check. you're going to put them to work and you're going to test them, right?
Very much so.
And again, it is not a waste, you know, for them. I'm sure there's a value, there's money to be paid for this. So therefore, you want to get the best out of it. And you want to make sure that your time is also, you know, being managed well. And the expectations are there. So I love the fact that you're clear about it. And you take people who are serious. folks.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, again, just for audiences, listen, folks, if you're looking for the program that you really want, you know, the real McCoy, you can get the real McCoy, but you have to be ready for it. You know, so you know, there's no gimmicks. You know, I think Michael is clear about it. You want in, you better behave.
Exactly. You're willing to do the work.
Well, like everything else, right? I mean, success. Yeah. Does require commitment and, you know, hard work and, you know, and you know, real, you got to put the time, you know, and the energy and the effort and the work and no cutting corners.
Well, completely agree. And, you know, we're Americans and we want everything yesterday. We want immediate gratification. Technology supports immediate gratification. Biohacking, like, you know, hack your system so you effective change immediately. And I like biohacking, by the way, and I've been a biohacking since the 80s, but ultimately, there's no shortcuts. Like you actually, like you said, you got to do the work, you got to be disciplined, you got to have structure, you got to have practices if you want to grow. and not just talk about growth, but actually grow.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, talk is cheap, as they say, right? Talk, you got to talk the talk, walk the walk. So I think you put it, you put people to the test here. So
exactly.
Well, exactly. Well, listen, I mean, do they have to be physically in your area, or you can work with people remotely?
No, I've been really fortunate. I have clients from around the globe. I mean, so the time zones matter. I'm in Austin, Texas. Like, I've had clients who are like in Australia, which is 12 hours difference, which is a little nutty for them. But yeah, like most of my work is virtual. For couples or and for individuals, there are times where I will fly to you to do an intensive, like a literally next month, I'm flying off to Tennessee to work with a couple for a 2-day intensive. And I've done that with individuals, but a lot of my work is virtual. So as long as I have Wi-Fi, I can work with a client.
There you have it. So again, no excuse. Well, no, because just, you know, sometimes people are like, well, I don't feel like traveling to you, right? So this program can work no matter where you are. So, you know, you can, you know, and all the work and everything done. Now, how often, I mean, is it daily? Is it weekly? Weekly, I'm assuming, but is it daily? Or how many hours do you have to commit to? To give an idea to people.
All right. So for the 6-month program, we meet every other week for a client session. But there'll be weekly spot drills. So you'll get a text from me with a spot drill. You'll have weekly homework. You'll have monthly crucibles. These are big challenges or quarter work. The big challenge is maybe once a year, every 6 months, every quarter. But we do monthly challenges too. It can be physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, interpersonal, a wide variety of different challenges. And I would say, minus the time we spend together in the individual session, you know, 30 minutes to an hour a day. I would say, because it's not bad, because part of it is like AM and PM rituals. Like, I help clients develop rituals that start their day to get their body open and ready and energy flowing, their heart, so they can be loving, more compassionate, more caring, more grateful, their mind, so they can be front side focused and take on the day. Then we do rituals at night. Like, how do you reflect back on your day, learn your lessons, calm the system down, prepare yourself for sleep, all those kind of things. So like, those are an important part of my work as well as the homework and the spot drills and other things. And so that, or maybe an hour at the most a day.
Well, thank you. And the main reason I ask that is that people always have the first excuse, I don't have time. Now, I think we all have an hour to spare, you know, if we wanted to really change who we are and for the better and develop. So we all, I mean, I do my own, you know, little thing, you know, a day that I need to whether it's a gym, whether it's, you know, certain things. And I guess everybody, you know, has a way to do that. But sometimes we need the guidance and we need the structure, and you afford that and you provide that for them. So, So thank you for that. Well, dude, I mean, the hour flew by. I don't know how.
It did fly by, yeah.
I don't know. You already tapped into your rhythm and your bio system, because I think this is past bedtime, I believe, right? You know, at least on your clock. By the way, you know, I just had a show about sleep, and, you know, the doctor.
Oh, sweet.
He said 10 o'clock. You know, no later is where you're really supposed to sleep, but no later than 6 a.m. when you're supposed to be up. So again, I don't know if that aligns with your work, but you know, your formula, but that's like, you know, coming from a sleep professional.
Nice. Who was the, do you remember the guest's name?
His name was Dr. Bijoy John. I mean, the show just aired yesterday or today. So
nice. Okay.
It's a fresh show.
I'll take a look at it.
It's all about sleep. And I think there's another one coming up, you know, about sleep as well. So I believe sleep is a good, you know, piece of life, and we need to re-energize. But he broke it down to like almost like a strategy of why and how and what.
That's awesome. Okay.
The whole thing about it, and best times to do certain things, and, you know, what to avoid before and all that. So it was pretty cool. You know. So I was curious, because I know you talked about, you know, how people have to be
right.
In the right time frame. So that's kind of aligns, you know, well with what he said. So I tend to agree.
I appreciate that. Thank you for talking to me too, because you're East Coast, man.
No worries, man. It's a great talk, and it's a great exchange. So just before we close, is there anything you want to leave our audiences with?
Yeah, I would say this, kindness. You know, we never know what someone else is going through. And I've heard some amazing stories, which are both heartbreaking and heart-opening, where someone was on the way to commit suicide, and someone actually did or said something kind to them and stopped them in their tracks and changed their minds, and they decided not to commit suicide. And that's an extreme example, but you just never know what someone's gone through. And this is a smile, open the door for someone, buying them a cup of coffee down the street, you know, whatever you could do to consider like a random act of kindness for any other human being can go a long way and literally can save a life.
Powerful. I mean, you know, I didn't ask for all that good stuff, but you gave it to me. I'll take it. So thank you. Nice. I appreciate it. And how can people get in touch with you? What's the best?
So, Michael D. Osterlenk, OSTROLENK.com, my website. There's a form on there to fill out to make contact with me. If you want to do a discovery call. And I'm way too active on Instagram, MOsterlenk, MOSTROLENK. And I do a lot of videos, like teaching videos. So you'll find videos on there teaching various topics in transpersonal or somatic psychology, relationship self, mental toughness, emotional resiliency, all those kind of good stuff. So you can also find me there and DM me if you want to chat. Yeah. Thank you for asking.
No worries. You mentioned podcasts. So what's the name of your podcast?
Thank you. You know, literally, if you go to any of the podcast systems you have on your iPhone, type in my last name, Osterlenk, you'll find my podcasts. There's different names I've had over the years because I've been doing it so long. But if you just literally put my last name in, you'll find my podcast.
All right.
Yeah, there thanks,
you
go.
Well, no, I mean, you got plenty of ways so people can tap into your resource, and you are a resource. So, that's always awesome. And so thank you for sharing all that. Well, folks, that's it. I mean, Michael, it was a pleasure and an honor having you here today with me and, you know, sharing your values with our audiences. I enjoyed it. So, folks, we're coming to the end of the show. So hope you've enjoyed it as well. We'll be talking soon with a new show, new topic, new things. Bye for now.